comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Well then, if we can get the pilot to push the right buttons, we may be able to actually take off here. Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful planet, thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on earth, and it's the show where you matter. Let me say also how much I appreciate all of our wonderful affiliates across the United States and around the world. Thank you so much for carrying the show and making it available to your audience. Interesting stuff happening all around the world, as usual. This report has just come out. It actually, the event took place on May the 1st, on Saturday, May the 1st, but it's just now, the news of it is just now getting out. And this was in Inverness. It was the sighting of 25 orange lights, and there were eight students who were holidaying in 4 years to celebrate completing their university courses. And it happened about between 11 o'clock and midnight on Saturday, May the 1st. And what they saw was about 25 bright lights, orange in color, going across the sky. The lights came out from behind some trees and then went across the sky, and they were all equally spaced. And at first, one of the girls thought, well, that must be those Chinese wedding lanterns. But then they decided maybe not, because they were moving in such a systematic way and staying evenly spaced. They said there was no wind and no sound. And at one point, one of the lights, two of the lights, almost collided with each other, but then changed directions and moved away from each other. So they don't really know what it was, but what's interesting is that on May the 2nd, the day after the girls made their discovery, there was a man from the Royal Air Force, and let's see, his name is, well, I don't see his name, but we'll, I think his name is in there. Anyway, he said, I am an aviation enthusiast. I know planes when I see them, but I've never seen anything like this before. UFOs are not something I have really thought about, but this was definitely unexplained, and it was definitely not a Chinese lantern. I couldn't put my finger on what it was, but it wasn't an aircraft. And then there was a very interesting statement by Michael Mulford, an RAF spokesman. He said, at any time there could be a helicopter flight or training exercises going on. However, now listen to this, nothing has come to our attention that has caused us any concern. I certainly cannot give any explanation to what was seen. Yeah, no kidding. All right, we'll be back in just a moment, and my guest this evening, James Clarkson.
Thank you.
My guest this evening is James Clarkson. He is a lifelong career law enforcement officer, starting as an MP in the U.S. Army. He then served as a police officer, retiring as sergeant from the Aberdeen Police Department, and during his career supervised field training officers, the fatal accident team, and also served as a child abuse detective as a commissioned deputy sheriff. James Clarkson is the MUFON state director in the state of Washington and has lectured extensively, both in front of live audiences in the Washington, Oregon area, and on radio. James, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, good evening, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, James, let me just start off by thanking you for your years of service. Your bio says that you have had a lifelong interest in UFOs and in the study of UFOs. But right here at the beginning, let me ask, is there any one event, any one experience that sparked that interest?
Well, actually, I have to say that my perspective on UFOs is, unfortunately, I guess I've always been a bridesmaid but never a bride. I'm interested in the field because of the compelling quality of the evidence, the convincing nature of the witnesses, and by the sheer quantity and quality of all of the evidence when added together. But my start happened a long time ago, actually because of a radio show.
Tell us about it.
I was grew up in San Francisco, California, and when I was a teenager, I believe my parents were gone for the weekend. I was listening to KGO Radio, and they were interviewing an author named John G. Fuller. And at the time, he had just come out with what was then a new book. This was in the, the mid-60s, and the book was titled Incident at Exeter. And this, of course, refers to some very famous UFO sightings, what would be close encounters of the first kind, between police officers, civilian witnesses, and some sort of a very peculiar structured vehicle that was the classic saucer shape, and as I recall, had scintillating red lights that were going around its rim. And at one point, it got so low over the officers that one officer started to draw his revolver while he was contemplating whether he was going to have to knock this civilian witness to the ground to keep him safe. The other officer yelled at him not to, and then the object went away. But when it was all over and done with, the Air Force dismissed it by saying that these were tankers, aerial refueling that was occurring over the area. And this was especially interesting to me because one of the police officers was an Air Force veteran, and I guess somehow this was the right thing at the right time. And I was obviously always interested in law enforcement since I was very young, and I just couldn't understand how it was that here we had highly trained officers who are qualified to drive emergency vehicles and carry loaded firearms, and yet the Air Force could just definitively pronounce and say that they couldn't tell the difference between an object that was about to come down on top of them and something flying high overhead. And somehow the nature of this story was so compelling that I started collecting books and articles. And like many other things in life, my interest waxed and waned over the years. And it wasn't until, I guess, the next key event was when, actually, I was at Fort Lewis, Washington, and I was a plainclothes military policeman. And one night, I was looking at the, talking to the desk sergeant, and I happened to look down underneath this plexiglass that was over the top of his desk, and it had probably a couple dozen business cards for various emergencies. And I was suddenly drawn to a card that said National UFO Reporting Center. And bear in mind, This is at the Provost Marshal's office on Fort Lewis, Washington. This is an active Army post. In fact, it's definitely the largest Army base in Washington State. And I asked the desk sergeant, I said, "What's that card?" And he very matter-of-factly looked at me and said, "That's where we report UFOs."
Oh, you gotta love it.
I know, and I never forgot that. In fact, I actually memorized the number right on the spot.
You know,
it wasn't until years later that I utilized that number. After I had been discharged and I was beginning my law enforcement career, it was actually another sighting that went all across the media that everyone was really excited about, and for good reason. This was 1986, and I believe it was the pilot of a JAL cargo liner was flying towards Anchorage, and he and his entire crew had a, as I recall, 20-30 minute encounter with an extremely large UFO. And initially it was confirmed by radar. The FAA said that there was something there. And then, of course, in classic fashion, after it hit the news and everyone got really excited, they retracted their affirmation the next day and said, oh, it was a mistake, and we didn't really have it on radar. And I was so excited about this that I ended up calling that phone number that I memorized. And interestingly enough, the gentleman who answered the phone was Robert Gribble. And Robert Gribble was a retired Seattle firefighter who was so interested in UFOs that he took it upon himself to create the National UFO Reporting Center. And when he decided to pass the torch, when he retired, he passed it to Peter Davenport, who serves in that capacity to this day. And in fact, I had the honor of appearing in an event where Peter Davenport was the master of ceremonies just this last weekend.
Well, let's back up and talk about a couple of things here.
Sure.
I also am an ex-cop, and it's always...
How many years? I don't know where you worked.
Yeah, I started out as a deputy sheriff in northeast Louisiana in Ouachita Parish. And then I was moved from there after a sheriff's election. Our sheriff finally retired. We had an election. And, you know, there's always generally a shakeup in the sheriff's offices. At least that's true for Louisiana after an election. And so I became a city policeman in the city of Grambling, where Grambling State University is. And then I was a detective there, and then I was a detective over at Richwood Police Department, and then I became international police and finished out my career as an international policeman, with that being overseas. When I was a deputy sheriff, we had the National UFO Reporting Center telephone number in the communications center. And I kind of had to smile when you were talking about the provost having it on his desk. Also, you said that one of the things that really caused you to gravitate toward what you're doing now is you mentioned several things, but one was the quality of the witnesses. And I find that to be really important, and I find it to be interesting because the other side, if you will, that being those who say there are no UFOs, particularly the U.S. Air Force, they don't often say there are no UFOs. What they say is, as you said, well, you misidentified it. That was a refueling operation. But they would have us to believe that our eyes are wrong 100% of the time when UFOs are involved. Now, your eyes are good enough and your brain good enough and coordinated together well enough that you can drive a car, that you can walk down the street. You don't turn left when you think you're turning right. You know where you are. You see oncoming traffic. You judge distance. But if there's a UFO involved, 100% of the time, they would have us believe our eyes are wrong. Now, as a cop, you and I both have been detectives, and we've talked to lots of witnesses, and they don't all have the same level of technical knowledge about various things. For instance, a robbery takes place, and you're talking with a witness, and the witness says it was a black gun. He had a black gun. And you say, well, could you tell, you know, was it a revolver or an automatic? Well, I don't know. And then you start describing things. Well, I mean, did it have, like, and you show them what a cylinder looks like, and you have this cylinder there, or was it more compact and flat? And they give you a description. Now, they may not know the technical terms, but they give you good quality information, and they give you the description. And yet, if a UFO is involved, we're supposed to believe that they're not qualified to be witnesses. And I find that to be absolutely ludicrous. How do you see
Without
it?
A doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I try to, when I look at the UFO, I guess I'd have to kind of amplify my response to what you've just said by saying that it's a lot to do with always keeping in mind where you're going. In other words, if you're investigating a robbery, our goal is to determine exactly who the suspect was and exactly how they were armed. And so there's value to be had from every witness. They may not, each one of them may not have the entire truth, but together they do. And well, I would point out that I believe that that's the same thing that's true of the UFO question. Now, mm-hmm. How exactly to add up all of the descriptions and all of the information, that would be a huge undertaking. But if you think about signal versus noise, there's always been a signal. And I think, obviously, one of the things that appeals to me so much about this subject is that when you get into it, you not only end up studying contemporary UFO sightings, you, of course, study the history. You end up in ancient history. You end up going all these places you never thought you would go. And yet, I always try to keep in mind one thing. And I believe it was Stanton Friedman who pointed this out first, but it's a point that always needs to be made. How many UFOs that are directly related to extraterrestrial intelligence do we have to prove that we are not alone and that contact has occurred? And the answer is only one. We don't need to prove that every single UFO incident is 100% verifiable or that each one is or isn't evidence of extraterrestrial contact. We need to look at the overall body of evidence and the quality of the testimony, and I personally came to the conclusion quite a while ago that there would be more than enough here that when as a police officer, people started telling, when everybody independently started pointing towards one particular person as being responsible for a crime, and I'm sure you would relate to this too, knowing your experience, you get ready to arrest somebody.
Yeah.
Or if you were in a court of law and all the witnesses are testifying to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon the jury is convinced. And I think the jury's been back for a long time on the UFO issue.
Oh, I do too. I think the debate...
Most people believe that we have been contacted.
I think the debate over whether UFOs are real, whether they exist, I think that debate has been over, done with, and dead now for a couple of decades. There are people still trying to debate whether they even exist. And I chuckle and swear at the same time with so-called mainstream media, because they still are dealing with whether people believe in UFOs or not. What stupid nonsense. I mean, that debate's over, and there's nothing to believe. Either they exist or they don't. And if they do, then they just do. There's nothing to believe. And but that debate's over. There's enough. Look, I'm sure that you remember the Peterson trial. I can't think of his first name, but he's the young guy that was accused of killing his pregnant wife They took him to court and they got a conviction and he's on death row. There's less evidence that he did that, less evidence, and he's on death row, but far less evidence than exists to say that UFOs are a reality. There's far more evidence that tell us that UFOs are a reality. So we've got people on death row convicted on less evidence than exists for UFOs. I think the debate's over.
I do too, but I also, one of the phrases that I try to keep in mind that I heard a long time ago is a Latin phrase, and it's qui bono, who benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is what every good detective knows, that whenever you want to solve a case involving fraud or theft or whatever, you follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
Who benefited from the crime would tend to be a good indication of who might have done it. And whenever you're dealing with UFOs, everybody has a bias or a faction or a point of view. I don't subscribe to the philosophy that law enforcement officers are completely unbiased or free of prejudice, because as you well know, like I do, they recruit us from the human race.
Yeah.
And we do the best we can to be fair and objective and try and meet standards of admissibility for evidence, but at the same time, you can't be involved in an investigation without it having some kind of an effect on you. And more especially true if you have an agenda. And I would say, number one, obviously some of the powers that be have an agenda of trying to convince us that they have complete control over our skies and that they can say absolutely who comes and goes, and that they can reassure us that, you know, all is well. Don't look at the man behind the curtain. The great Oz has everything well in hand. Well, reality just doesn't fit with that. And when I come back, even if I take all of the, if I strip away all the civilian witnesses and deal with nothing but law enforcement, military, and pilots, I think even with that, which isn't fair to one heck of a lot of very fine witnesses.
Hate to do it, but we have a break taking over. We're going to have to step away for just 2 or 3 minutes. We'll be back, and we'll pick up right there when we come back. And welcome back. We're talking with James Clarkson. He is the MUFON state director in the state of Washington and is a lifelong police officer as well. You were talking about witnesses and the testimony, and we had to step away for break, so I want to give you a chance to finish your thought.
Yes. The point I was making was that if you just take the witnesses, for instance, military people, law enforcement officers, and pilots, if you took just what they have reported, you would have an overwhelming case that something extremely strange and unexplained has been going on for a long time, and that conventional explanations will not work, and that the, I guess, extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional explanation would probably do more to explain it than anything else. And the one of the reasons, aside from the fact that these people are trained observers, that I'm really interested in their reports, is that every one of those people is taking a risk by making a report. So you have to ask yourself, why would a highly trained professional put their career on the line to stand behind a UFO report? Here's a transient event, maybe. No, a five-minute UFO sighting is an extremely long UFO sighting.
Yeah.
Why would they risk their entire career for something that they've seen in order to stand behind it, put their reputation down, and say, look, this really happened, it's real, and I'm telling you this is what I saw? I keep saying, why would they take that kind of a risk? What induces a person to do that?
Well, let's do, I agree with you, but let's do a flip side of that, because we know of instances, you and I, and other cops that are listening, we know of instances where cops have seen UFOs and have refused to admit that they see them. Now, one quick story, just as an example. Right here in Maricopa County, that's where Phoenix, Arizona is located, there was a UFO incident where a citizen called the sheriff's office and said, there is a UFO, and it's hovering over my ranch, and it's big. Well, they took their time getting there, but when they got there, it was still there. And the citizen asked the rather startled sheriff's deputy, do you see what I see? And he looked up at the thing, and then he looked back at the citizen, and he said, I don't see anything. And he got in his car and drove away. Now, that kind of thing happens. And by the way, there were other people there. I've interviewed the citizen and some a couple of other people that were there that verify that it was there, and that the deputy did say that, and he very definitely saw it. But there are situations like that where you have cops, and I would assume military as well, but I know about cops because I are one, and where they just absolutely refuse to admit that it exists. They're not going to report it. They're not going to say they saw it. And why is that?
Well, you're sort of asking a question about the internal makeup of a particular individual during a key event. I kind of think that we get tested throughout our lives, and especially as law enforcement officers, you get put in situations where you have to make really difficult decisions. And I get there's no accounting for exactly how people arrive at those decisions. And I guess I would have to say I'd be extremely disappointed in that deputy sheriff. And yet at the same time, I could sort of understand. I mean, for all I know, maybe he had a religious background that wouldn't allow him to process that kind of an event. Maybe he was afraid he would lose his job if he endorsed it. There's a whole lot of, you know, very human motives as to why he would deny what was obvious to everybody who was there.
Yeah, and, you know, now what I'm about to say is not because I am a UFO enthusiast. I really would not even say that I am. I'm a truth enthusiast. But if I were the sheriff and that came to my knowledge, that there would be some discipline involved with that. Because, you know, it doesn't matter how weird the information is. If it's information, it's got to go in the report. And you've had people tell you things that absolutely sounded outlandish, witnesses. But it had to go in the report because that's what they said. And, you know, it doesn't. You're not saying that you buy it. You're just saying this is what they told me. And I think these cops all over the country really have a duty to just report the facts and let it fall where it falls, and it is what it is. But there are some, and I've talked to some, that I know witnessed a UFO event that absolutely refused to talk about it. And it was with the sheriff's office that I used to work for. And I know they witnessed it because I listened to the radio traffic and heard them on the radio talking about it and reporting back to headquarters. But after the event, it didn't happen. And I think that's a shame. All right, now let's move to something a little bit more up to date. Being you as the director, the state director for MUFON in Washington State, obviously you have field investigators that you oversee, and their reports come in, and you get to see all of these reports, and you may be involved in some of the field investigations as well. Is there anything of any interest with UFOs happening recently or in current times?
Well, I guess I would have to say yes and no. By that I mean I had a disclosure recently, a case that I'm looking into, by someone I spent a long period of time interviewing, but he was so worried about what people would think of him that he had waited about 10 years to report this event.
Ah.
But what he reported was quite extraordinary, even by UFO standards, and yet somehow it was one of those kind of reports that you only run into every once in a while. A lot of UFO reports are obviously light-in-the-sky cases,
mm-hmm.
and there isn't really ultimately much you can do with them. You kind of go out the same door that you went in with those investigations. But every once in a while, you run across something that makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And the one that I'm thinking of does because of the implications. And what this involved was a location in eastern Washington, right on the border with Oregon, kind of the southeast part of this state and the northeast part of Oregon. Kind of a remote area, sort of farming country, rolling hills, some brush vegetation. We have two young men get off work. This gentleman that I interviewed, by the way, is a millwright. They go fishing. He points out to me repeatedly, he says, "We did not drink. We went fishing." He indicated to me that he didn't drink very much, period. They're coming back up a country road. It's a very beautiful evening. It's completely clear out. And what happens next is that he describes that the air goes slack. And the way he described it was that all the sound went out of the air and everything was different. It was very, very quiet. Unnaturally so. And then he said that while he and his friend were standing there, something came by him very low over the ground. And the part that he was reluctant to tell me, he had gone as far as making a report to MUFON, but I could tell from the way that he put it in there that he was holding something back. So after I'd interviewed him for some 30, 40 minutes, he finally told me what it was. This thing was cloaked. And the way he described what happened, you have to imagine yourself inadvertently standing on a runway at a major airport, and you have a 747 roll right by you, only it's invisible. So he had the sensation of a massive machine, this presence of a huge mass going by him, and he described the surface as he could vaguely make out the shape because he was so close to it. And he said it was as if you stood too close to a television set, a giant television set, so that everything in the air kind of rezzed out, and you could see the image of what was behind it, but it wasn't right. And he could make out a curved shape. And this thing went by him, and it took quite a while to go by. And he stepped out of the way, he said literally, because he thought that it was going to hit him and crush him or push him into the earth. And his friend was just standing there with his jaw hanging out, down in a complete state of shock. And he's not quite sure how long it took for this thing to go by, but it was long enough that he said that whatever it was enormous. And so after it went by, the air returned to normal. He could hear all of the natural sounds, the breeze, everything come back. But he and his friend looked at each other, and the way he described it, he said that he had just witnessed the most extraordinary and wonderful thing he had ever seen in his life, and I guess seen might be the wrong word, but experienced. And yet he had absolutely no idea what it was. He was convinced that it was made by someone or something. And I guess that what really got my attention was this individual was extremely credible. I went over a lot of his life history. He'd been a millwright all of his life. He'd been responsible for going to various locations and assembling complex machinery and making sure that it worked. I mean, this is not a this is an individual who's pretty, has a definite good grip on reality and a very practical nature, and he had kept this story to himself because he was afraid that people would say he was crazy, and yet he was absolutely convinced that it was real. And I guess the reason that I bring this story up is that it has profound implications, because it makes me wonder how many things are coming and going all the time that we're just absolutely not aware of.
Well, what I'm about to ask you is a little bit speculative, I guess, but do you think if perhaps he were able to look at this thing with infrared goggles, that he would have been able to see it?
It's hard to say. He didn't indicate that it was hot, although that's a very good point. And, of course, obviously there's a number of different ways that that we are now able to look at things that allow us to see things that, you know, up until that point we would have considered as non-existent.
All right, now he's...
infrared, ultraviolet, X-ray. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at the way our galaxy looks when they look out into space, depending on what kind of telescope they use.
Yeah. Now, well, we have a break taking over. When we come back, I want to address the fact that he's still a bit hesitant about anybody knowing that he's reported this. We'll be back, folks, in 2 or 3 minutes. Don't go away. Welcome back. My guest this evening is James Clarkson, and we're talking about his work as the state director for MUFON in the state of Washington. Now, when we went away, you were mid-sentence again, and I want to give you the opportunity to finish your thought.
Well, I believe we were talking about a particular incident, and during the break I was looking it up. The incident actually took place in 1983 in the vicinity of a place called Umapine, Oregon. And we were describing the question of whether or not this very, very odd vehicle could be perceived with some other kind of instrumentation or technology, and the answer would probably be yes, although since we're dealing with an unknown technology, it becomes pure speculation.
Now, did he hear anything as it passed by him?
No, that was, in fact, the exact opposite. He described this slackening. He called it the air went slack. And after spending some time with him, I was reminded of what I have read in some of the literature on people who have close encounters, more especially alien abduction events, that they describe a moment that occurs before the event where reality kind of jumps. It moves to a higher level. Things become more intense. The sometimes described as the air becoming thick, something like that. That was the kind of feeling that he had. In other words, it's like a wave of some sort that preceded this vehicle and then followed it after it went away slightly.
Mm-hmm. So he didn't hear anything. What about feel? Now, did he feel like any electric charge or anything like that as it passed?
It's kind of a overall sensation of being next to something huge that was about to smash him. I mean, he said he stepped out of the way because he thought he was about to be run down somehow.
Yeah, but he didn't feel the sensation of like static electricity or something like that.
No.
Hmm. All right, now, all these years he's been reticent to come forward with this information, and you indicated he's still not it's still not really he doesn't want his name out there. Why is he still reticent about this after all this time and the changes in our culture that have made it where, I mean, you even have astronauts stepping forward?
Well, I guess it depends on your own perception of how advanced we really are on this subject, and it might possibly depend on who your peer group is and where you work. I have a sighting that I investigated a year ago that I am 100% convinced is absolutely bona fide valid. I know the witness, and I know exactly why he won't identify himself, because he is an airline pilot.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a broad daylight sighting over the Houston Intercontinental Airport in August of 2009. This is an object that appears in restricted airspace, described as an orange ball. And at one point, the aircraft turns because they're waiting to taxi, and the entire flight crew witnesses this very odd orange ball and this kind of antenna-like thing that's sticking down from it. And then the large orange ball proceeds to drop a smaller ball of light that drops downward and then disappears. And then the entire object moves from one point to another very quickly. And the strange part about this whole encounter is, I guess what adds to the credibility is that aside from the fact that I know the witness, is that his reaction was anger. He wanted to know what that idiot was doing in restricted airspace, because here he is in a whole group of loaded airliners that are waiting to take off, you know, thousands of people involved, landing and taking off at an airport in broad daylight, and he wants to know who this crazy maniac is who's flying something that he can't identify in restricted airspace. And he's concerned that it might interfere with his takeoff.
Did he...
the other aircraft.
Did he address those concerns to flight control?
No, because he was about to key the mic and report it, and the two flight officers he was with said, "Don't do it, don't do it." They were afraid. That's what brought it to mind. They mm-hmm. were afraid of being branded, afraid that it would impair their personal careers. So imagine the stress. You know, I imagine that probably more than anything, they were hoping this thing would disappear, which it did.
Why do you think the airlines have this practice of punishing pilots that report UFOs?
Because they need to maintain an image of being absolutely dependable, respectable people. I mean, you know, I don't like flying anyway, and I wouldn't want to think that there was some, I guess in general, people would not want to think that their pilot was capable of seeing something that, you know, other people don't even admit that it exists. And I guess it's the airline company trying to err on the side of how do we maintain our professional reputation.
Well, the emperor has no clothes. We're at the point now, and these people are that run airlines are smart. They're not stupid, but they need to get a clue. They don't have any clothes on this issue. And the public is way ahead of the curve here. And, you know, while they're saying, hey, it's not there, it doesn't exist, and you've got people looking out of airplane windows looking at it and getting it on video sometimes, you know, they're not helping their image at all by telling everyone flying you didn't see what you saw. You know, the emperor has no clothes. The same thing is true with the Air Force and the stupid spin stories they put out. And they've been scorched so badly over some of their spin stories of late, over the past couple of years, that they're not putting out spin stories much anymore. You know, and I always say, look, I understand if you have to use a cover story. I may not agree with it, but I understand. But for goodness sake, get better script writers. I mean, they put out some of the stupidest spin stories. A third grader could tell it's a spin story. But it's really unfortunate. And, you know, I think, let me throw this out and see what you think about this. I think any cop, any commercial airline pilot, anybody like that that reports a UFO and then has their career dumped on, they ought to file a lawsuit and carry into court the literal box after box after box after box of documents from major scientists that say they exist. And those documents do exist. And I think, you know, if they sue for, do a class action suit, everybody that's ever worked for an airline and got dumped because of this, do a class action suit. Hit them for about $100 million in back wages. Win your lawsuit, and this nonsense will be over.
I don't think you'd win.
I think you would. I think you can document with scientific evidence. Now, you may not be able to document that these are extraterrestrial, but you can certainly document with scientific evidence and even with FAA records that these things exist, whatever they are.
Well,
and I think you could win.
What happens, though, when if we go back to, and there's actually an example for this, with the Betty Cash and Vicki Landrum sighting in Texas on December 29th of 1980, and we have an actual court proceeding where they sue to get medical compensation for their obviously radiation-induced injuries.
Yeah.
And you have a government agency, one of the, you know, black alphabet agencies, goes to the judge and says, "Your Honor, we need an in-camera hearing because the material being discussed in this courtroom has national security implications." I agree with you that in a fair court of law, we would win such a lawsuit overwhelmingly beyond any shadow of a doubt by any jury, that I would even let them pick their jury.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in the second hour, welcome aboard. We are glad to have you, and you have my sincere sympathy for having missed the first hour. But we're glad you're here. We're talking with James Clarkson. He is the director, the state director for MUFON in the state of Washington. And we were talking about the Cash Landrum case. And the fact that one of the alphabet agencies stepped forward and said, "Your Honor, we need to take this in camera," which, of course, folks, means in chambers, because there are national security implications here. And I think, you know, that's always a possibility, that national security card is one that they play often, and seems they play it more often as time goes on. It's an easy card to play. But somewhere down the road, there may be, just maybe, a judge that will say, "Tell you what, Alphabet, I'm part of the nation. And these people in this courtroom are part of the nation. And if you want to tell why this is a national security issue, go right ahead. Otherwise, this trial is continuing, and you can respond right now, or we continue." And somewhere down the road, maybe, there's going to be a judge with just enough Constitution blood in him and just enough guts to do that. And it would be entirely constitutional and legal for him to do it. Are you still with us, James?
I absolutely am. I was just kind of chiming in and applauding you, and I totally agree. One thing I always tell everybody, no matter where I speak, is that the truth about this issue belongs to every man, woman, and child on this planet. It is not the property of any government, and I don't care what their intentions are for keeping it a secret. If we have absolute proof that we've been contacted by a non-human intelligence, I don't know about everybody else, but I always think it's better to know than not know, and I would like to know the truth.
Yes, and, you know, here's the deal. The fact that there is contact, the fact that, yes, we know they exist, that's not national security. They need to quit even spilling that nonsense out of the bucket. Now, if they have received technology, if they have back-engineered technology, they don't have to tell us about all of that, you know, but just putting a blanket over the whole issue, it's like I said, the emperor's got no clothes. The public is way ahead of the government spin doctors on this. And when disclosure, when revelation takes place, that's when UFO occupants decide to reveal themselves, and they, if they decide they're just not going to wait any longer, and they decide to just reveal themselves to us. When that happens, then every government that's been keeping a blanket on this is going to be adjudged by those whom they govern to be irrelevant. So if they want to remain relevant, and that means hold on to their jobs and keep their power, they're going to have to get out in front of the band and pretend they're leading instead of saying there is no halftime show here. Because the halftime show is on, we're all watching it, we've all seen these things, we know they exist, and their nonsense doesn't work anymore. Anyway, that's the end of my rant. Tell you what let's do. Let's open up the telephone lines and invite our audience to join us. The telephone number, the main number here in the studio, is 623-444-5889 or toll free 888-223-4599. That's a toll free number in the United States and Canada. So if you're on a calling plan where you can call me without it costing you long distance, use the 623 number. If you need to call me on toll-free, you can do so. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can call our 623 number, 623-444-5889. Works anywhere in the world. Or if you don't want to make the international long-distance call and you're outside of the USA and outside of Canada, you can use the flash message option on my website. Just go over to my website and click on the link that says flash message. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Ryan in Washington.
Hi, Ryan.
Oh, boy, this is a really great show tonight. Hi, James.
How are you doing?
Well, it's great to see somebody from my local neighborhood on. Good show tonight. Is there a hot spot in Washington State where if somebody wanted to go and do a skywatch where there's a lot of UFO activity? And also, can you talk for a while about your friendship with June Crane? And I'll just take it off the air, and I'll let the next caller come in.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. The answer to that is that no, there isn't any one particular hot spot. The biggest problem we have in Washington State, of course, is west of the mountains, is getting it clear enough that you can see anything in the sky. But there are nobody can really predict exactly when or where this phenomena is going to make itself known. And just to comment briefly about my friend June Crane, because we could probably do, I have done 2 or 3 hours lecture on her, and she is the subject of a book that I now have out there. But June Crane was a lady that I met in Ocean Shores, Washington in 1993, and I didn't know when I met her, but it turns out that when she was a young woman, between 1942 and 1952, She worked in classified laboratories at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And because she was working around scientists and engineers all the time, she got to hear the difference between what they tell the public and what they talk about in private. And this is a perfect example of when you said the emperor's new clothes, or the fact that there really is an elephant in the room that everybody wants to pretend isn't there. She knew it firsthand, and I became her friend, although not until 1997, 4 years later, because she took her national security oath very seriously and was very patriotic. But in 1997, she got very angry because of the news coverage that came out when they started talking about how all of the aliens were actually dummies dropped by parachutes, and that all the UFOs were actually weather balloons. And as she put it, she said, "I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands, and my cancer's in remission. What are they going to do, shoot me or put me in prison?" And that was when she and I became friends, and I had the extraordinary opportunity of interviewing her at length. She gave me all of her personal papers. We talked about her life, my life, UFOs, many subjects, and I consider myself honored by her friendship. And the last thing that she told me before she died, because I knew we wouldn't have much more time, she was terminal by August of 1998, I said, "What do you want me to do, June?" And she said, "Tell my story." And the power of what she had to tell me really boosted my interest in UFOs and made me become a committed, not only investigator, but an advocate for this subject to the public, because there's some point where we, those of us who care about this subject, we read things, we study, etc., but at some point it becomes intensely real for you. Maybe it's because of your experience, maybe it's because of somebody else's, but it changes you. And my life has been completely changed by telling June's story.
All right. 623-444-5889. Or 888-223-4599. We have a flash message here from Peter in Columbia. And this is a question for you, James. He says, "Can you please share a couple of the most creepy UFO or alien abduction cases that you've examined?"
I haven't had very many alien abduction cases, mainly because I don't have the resources to really take care of someone who has undergone that kind of a traumatic ordeal. I've tried when possible to refer them to others. As far as cases that creep me out, one that comes to mind actually involves a law enforcement officer. And he described to me, albeit reluctantly, at first he didn't want to tell me what he did for a living, but this was over in Eastern Washington. He was off duty. He was with his girlfriend. He was driving down a highway right near the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, by the way. And he sees a car pulled over ahead. This is at nighttime, clear night, perfect weather. And he sees a man standing in a field, and so he looks past the man and sees a very strange disc-shaped craft hovering over the ground. He pulled over, got out of his car, and approached the man, and they had a brief conversation. The man was transfixed and would hardly talk at all. Basically, he acknowledged that they were both looking at the same thing. This craft started to flash some sort of symbols, and I intend to re-interview this witness because I'm convinced there's more to this story. But his girlfriend started screaming in the car. She just completely freaked out over this thing, and he made a decision. And basically his decision was to run and to jump back in his car and drive away as fast as possible. And what really interested me was his law enforcement type reaction, because what really bothered him was the fact that he left that first witness standing in the field. And that's something that a cop would think. And yet I totally understand why he took care of his girlfriend and got out of there. And it's just one of those cases that the way he told it and the details that he related, that was another one of those ones that make the hair stand up on the back of your neck.
All right. Let's go to the telephone and caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, it's John from Vancouver Island.
Okay, John, you're going to have to speak up for us.
All righty. Hi, Kevin. Hi, James.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. This relates more to Sean and Clay the night before.
Well, let's stay focused on what we're dealing with here tonight.
All right. Well, here's the thing. They were talking about how the aliens, as far as what they knew, wanted grassroots response. They want to see it from the grassroots up. And what bothers me about that is that there's nothing within the UFO contact scenario that really helps any grassroots type of organization. Like, for example, I could organize a meeting, and if I said, well, if an alien, decided to attend the meeting, that would really help a grassroots type of organization. But we never see that. It's always nebulous. It's always...
Okay, what's your question for James?
For James, okay. Well, given the idea that a grassroots type of thing has been floated, I guess my question to James is, it doesn't seem like ETs are facilitating any way to create a grassroots type of response. Like right now, it's not possible to do that because contacts are either at a high level or they're in the way that your witnesses describe.
I guess I would have to respond to that by taking a step back and suggesting that we all need to take a much more profound and deeper look at the whole question of what exactly would contact look like. And there is no necessity that contact should occur any time in our lifetime, or that contact may not be an event that, from an alien perspective, might take generations, and as far as they were concerned, that would be perfectly fine. And then, of course, there's the additional variable that if you open the door and say there's one type of alien intelligence here, where there is one, there must by definition be many. And therefore there are as many different agendas as there could be types of beings and levels of being. And if you go to the point of saying that maybe time is irrelevant itself, then I'm not sure that there is going to be a clear-cut agenda other than that contact and the necessary enlightenment that I think precedes it is going on constantly, and it's going on right here at this moment with you and I and the listeners having this conversation. We're all getting tuned up. Our perceptions are increasing. We're all becoming more accustomed to the idea of life out there. I've noticed in the last year, I don't want to jump out here and say that I think disclosure is around the corner, because that always seems to be a dangerous thing to say, but I have noticed a lot of things that we were told were impossible when I was a young man. Everyone is saying, oh yeah, that's true. We find out now there's not a little water in space. They keep finding water everywhere. We've got Stephen Hawking out there talking about contact with aliens. We've got all these things going on that keep bringing it up and keep putting it out in front of people, and I see this all as a positive development. And I guess I'm perhaps take a broader view and I want to be patient and yet at the same time push for it.
Okay, John, thanks for the call. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Stefan in Quebec City.
Hello, Stefan.
Hello. James, thank you for... I just really like hearing what you're doing on the work here. Guys, what I'm thinking is, and this is sort of in response to John, but also as in relationship to the MUFON network, once disclosure or contact happens, UFOs will no longer exist because they'll no longer be identified. Would it be a good thing perhaps to step ahead of the game and get rid of the term UFOs and actually start calling them alien spacecraft or use another acronym?
Oh, I love it. Are you asking me that as the state director of MUFON in Washington State, or are you asking James Clarkson, the ufologist?
I'm asking the human being, sir.
Well, my answer is I love your thinking, and I'm totally for it, because, quite frankly, I think it's time that we just step out of the shadows and be who we are. I don't think MUFON is ready for that, and I can sort of understand why. MUFON is in a very precarious position, because if they endorse something, they open themselves up to being shot at from every side by mainstream media. So I can sort of understand why they're a little bit cautious. I would also point out that MUFON has many faces, and although we do have an international director and a main organization, the state organizations are as diverse as the people who are involved in them. So I may say things that, you know, other MUFON directors or people wouldn't agree with at all.
Okay. Well, that's all I have to ask, I guess. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin, and thank you, James.
All right. Thanks, Stefan. Yeah, but, you know, here's another consideration. Not everything that is a UFO is alien. It's unidentified to the general public. It may even be unidentified to the general military. But it may also be very identified to a very small group of black ops or people that are developing it as a black program. And so it's a UFO, but it's not alien. And, you know, there have been a number of those, and I am convinced that there are yet a number of them in existence that to us are UFOs.
I would certainly agree with that. And then, of course, there's even the lovely acronym of HPAC, which is Human Piloted Alien Craft. So there may be, you know, hybrid variations of alien technology that have been retro-engineered and successfully flown.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I'm sorry. Go ahead, James.
I was just going to say, the question I always have, though, is if some of these are top secret black ops aircraft, why do they fly them over civilians and populated areas?
Maybe to see what kind of reaction they would get.
It's possible.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they fly them over civilian areas, populated areas, and it's something people have never seen, they know everybody's going to say it's a UFO, and they know they're going to say, well, we didn't have any of our jets in the area, and as for UFOs, well, we don't know anything about that. We're not investigating UFOs. And there you go. They've done away with it. They can test those things anywhere they want to, anytime they want to, and use UFOs as the cover.
How convenient.
Yeah. Well, the plan to do that, there was an actual plan put together by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and by the Cabinet under Eisenhower. And under Eisenhower, the plan was talked about and then formalized to use UFOs, since they were happening, to use that as the cover for developing black aircraft. And they've been doing that since Eisenhower. So, all right, folks, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. toll-free, 888-223-4599. We have a flash message from Puerto Rico, and this is Leonardo, who I know because he's corresponded with us before, is also a former cop. And he says, "Hi, Kevin, good show, as always. Back when I was on the force, many of my brothers reported UFO sightings, and we never got harassed by the force." He's talking about the police force. And we had a good relationship with the press, and they printed what we saw. I remember a case when the National Enquirer came to investigate a great sighting in the southwestern part of the island. They even posted Lieutenant Garcia and Sergeant Rodriguez on the front page and reported on their sighting. That was in the late 70s. And then he says he hopes my family in Thailand are safe. And yes, they are. Thank you for your concern. Yes, they are. Let me say this, and then, James, I'll let you answer. Leonardo, you have to remember that Puerto Rico is not as infested, and cankerous as the United States of America. And, you know, it's here in the United States of America, there is no such thing as a free press. There's lamestream media, and they are 100% controlled. We'll be back right after this break. Welcome back. We are talking with James Clarkson. He is the Washington State MUFON director, and we were addressing, when we went away for break, the flash message that I got from Leonardo in Puerto Rico. And I said, it's Puerto Rico is a very, very, very different from the United States of America in terms of what's acceptable in culture and society. Here in the United States, there is no such thing as free press, free media. That is just something the politicians talk about. The press is controlled. The media is controlled. And, you know, if you even want to know what's going on in the rest of the world, you have to get on the internet and go to news sources outside of the USA to find out what's really going on in the rest of the world. That's my two cents on it. James, do you want to comment on what he had to say?
Yes, I first off would thank him very much, and I wish that we did have a more enlightened approach to UFOs and how we treat our witnesses. The case that comes to mind is Deputy Dale Spower, Portage County, Ohio, 1966, which to me symbolizes exactly how wrong we are and how arrogant we are in our approach to this. And he was a deputy who was basically put down by the Air Force, Major Quintanilla, Project Blue Book, etc. And Deputy Spower could not handle the stress, and he cracked up, lost his job, lost his wife, lost everything, because he stood on the truth of his UFO report, where he and his partner had chased an object that was described as half a football and as big as a house, over 80 miles, with hundreds of witnesses, multiple officers from other law enforcement agencies, and yet he was basically publicly ridiculed and disgraced by the Air Force rather than having the case seriously investigated, which is what it deserved to be. We could go on and on with examples. We are very arrogant in the way we treat people and in the way we treat other countries and in the way we treat what people have experienced. And that's something that I think needs to change, and I guess we change it person by person and by how you approach your investigations as a UFO investigator. You need to respect your witnesses and treat them with some sensitivity if you want to get at the truth.
When you were a detective with the police, what would have happened to you if you had treated a witness that way?
Well, I wouldn't get the information, which of course is the bottom line for whether or not you're going to be successful. And I suppose if you were arrogant enough, someone could make a complaint about you, but you would be ineffectual in your job, and you would not, you just wouldn't be serving your purpose at all. One of the things that I think is so important is that even if you can't explain what happened to someone, it's very important to be a compassionate listener, because you validate what they went through as one human being to another by showing them that you respect it, their experience, enough to listen to them and try and understand it.
This deputy is what we would call a material witness. And if in any case important enough to assign a detective to, if the detective discounts, ridicules, and makes fun of what the material witness says and discredits the material witness, that has an impact on the, it very well can have an impact on the outcome of any trial. And should that happen, the officer who did it, if the person filed a complaint, the officer who did it, once it was discovered that he did it, would likely be pretty severely disciplined, if not charged with malfeasance, because that's tampering with evidence. And that brings up something. The reason I get asked, why did I get interested in doing a talk show about UFOs and the paranormal? And the answer that I give is the reason that I got interested. I always had just sort of a fascination with anything that was out of the ordinary. But as a cop, you know, whenever evidence goes missing, that's where you need to start looking. That evidence was the critical evidence. Even if you never knew it was the critical evidence before, once it goes missing, it's missing for a reason. Now, it could be that it's just lost, but if it was taken, if the evidence was taken, if it's missing, then that's where you need to start looking, because there's something about that evidence that's critical, that's crucial. And when we look at UFOs, the evidence goes missing all the time in terms of mainstream media and in terms of what the government will tell us. There's a big black hole where there ought to be the evidence. And so it drew my attention, and that's why I got involved. How do you view that? If you're working on a case, you've got a box full of evidence, you get ready to review the evidence, and there's something missing from the box. Does that draw your attention?
Well, it would do more than draw my attention. I would say we would be looking at an internal affairs investigation if this was just before a critical criminal prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
This would be an extremely serious situation in a police department. I'm quite sure of that.
And, if there's evidence missing, the evidence that's still there tells you something. It tells you that it's not as critical as what went missing. There's something about what went missing that's critical. That's why it went missing. And so that's where you have to drill down and start looking for, you got to find that evidence, but you also have to start looking closely at what's so critical about that. And you may already know and you may not. But that's why I say the emperor has no clothes. The emperor is naked on this. The government's absolutely naked, and they're parading around as if they're wearing a tuxedo. The people know. People know what they've seen, and they know we haven't been told the truth. And, you know, we know that it's lies and cover-ups. And, you know, it's just time. It's way, way past time for the emperor to say, oops, and put on his bathrobe. It's time for the secret keepers to realize they aren't keeping secrets. We know. Now, one of the big things, James, that gets said all the time is that if the government were to disclose, if they were to just come out and tell us that UFOs are real and that we have had contact with them, there would be chaos in the streets. I want to get your take on that. What do you think?
I really seriously doubt it. People are going to evaluate any disclosure about anything on the basis of how it affects them directly.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, does it affect their ability to go to work tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Does it affect their ability to get their children to and from school? Will they still be able to go to the supermarket or buy gasoline or do all the things that we have to do in modern American society? As long as the UFO question doesn't directly impact that, I think most people would go, well, yeah, we knew that, and we would go on. And quite frankly, I think we would be better for it, and there would be a general... I think the government has a unique opportunity if somebody had enough guts to step up and say, yes, there were reasons why at the time we were afraid to tell you the truth about this, but those reasons are no longer relevant, and we've decided that it's time to tell you the truth about Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
But that would require a lot of courage on someone's part, but I suspect that once it was done, everything would be fine. I don't think people would... I really can't see why this would make people any crazier than hearing that the what the banks have done or what you know, any number of corrupt politicians have done. I can't see how this, how finding out that there were aliens would be any more shocking than what some of the news that we get all the time.
I agree. I agree with you absolutely. There is another aspect, though, of disclosure, and that is once they disclose, there are going to be a lot of people and a lot of family members of people who have had their lives destroyed by the U.S. government over this, trying to keep this secret, who will have legal standing to file some serious lawsuits and criminal charges. Do you think that should happen, or do you think the government ought to get immunity on this?
Well, I think that the individuals that come forward should get immunity. I've long been an advocate of that because, quite frankly, I think it's the only way that it's going to really get moving. Should the government in general have immunity? No, they should never have immunity. The government is supposed to belong to us, and I don't know why we got... Well, I sort of do. I mean, if you go back and think about the history of the secret government since World War II, I guess that's how we got to this point. But I don't think it was ever justified. It's not legal. I absolutely believe that we are a nation of law, and that law based upon the Constitution has to rule. And if the government or an individual is at fault, then they have to be held accountable. Now, that, of course, can be tempered with reason. It can be tempered with some good common sense, but they still would have to be held accountable. And yes, there probably would be lawsuits, and deservedly so.
So you don't subscribe to the idea that we ought to give immunity to the government or to the military. What about you know, this? I've always found this interesting. The excuse, I was just following orders. Now, the reason I find that interesting is at Nuremberg, we still hung people who said I was just following orders, because it was held by the court that those were blatantly illegal orders, and any reasonable person would have been able to identify that it was illegal and has an obligation to refuse illegal orders. So what do you think about that? When all this happens... And some military guy says, Well, I was just following orders when he's charged with destroying somebody's life.
Well, if you did something that was blatantly, I could never imagine myself deliberately hurting another person unless it was in self-defense. Or, you know, in other words, a situation where you had to do your duty. But I don't think I'm a malicious or an evil person. I think that you have an ultimate responsibility as a human being that goes above and beyond your national allegiance, and that's probably what you're really talking about when you say that the I was only fence doesn't really cut it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, we have to step away for a break. And we will return right after this. Welcome back to our discussion this evening with James Clarkson, who is the Washington State MUFON director. James, let me ask you a question. By the way, folks, in case you have forgotten, the telephone lines are still open. 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. James, let me pose a question that has come in a flash message from Ika, I guess is the pronunciation, and Ika is in Bosnia. And the question is, what is the most spectacular case you have investigated in Washington?
I think the answer to that would be the Westport UFO crash retrieval case, which actually happened on November 25th of 1979. I did not investigate this until 1987, but even after that much time had elapsed, I was able to locate over two dozen witnesses. And to make a long story short, basically I was able to track a unknown object that came down from on high that was seen over a distance of 40 or 50 miles by people who were driving down the road, people who were in their homes. Numerous people called in to report what they thought was a crash of an airplane. There never were any aircraft missing, and whatever it was, it made what I would describe as a last-ditch maneuver and made a turn across some mud flats and crashed near a bridge outside the town of Westport. I believe that it probably would have struck Westport if it hadn't made this maneuver. That's part one of the story. The next part that I was able to confirm was that the military came down and sealed off the logging roads. And by confirm, I mean that I was even able to find witnesses. They were loggers who couldn't care less about UFOs, but they were able to describe in great detail how they felt when they tried to go to work and they almost got into a fist fight with armed troops on these logging roads to get to their work sites. And so basically I constructed it like a huge puzzle and put it together, and I believe that now it has been accepted by the UFO research community as still another crash retrieval event. Now, I don't know for sure that it was extraterrestrial, but I eventually located an extremely reliable witness who saw what I have described as the other search party. And the day after this thing crashed, this individual witnessed multiple lights that were hovering around a larger light right over the crash site area that then took off in all directions at a velocity that my witness described as being completely impossible by any conventional aircraft. And this was a highly reputable natural scientist from the Pacific Northwest whom I know and who was even willing to identify himself and go on videotape. So that's probably the most interesting and involved investigation that I've had in the Pacific Northwest.
Do you have any idea what they did with the recovered craft?
No. A complete mystery.
So there were no witnesses that saw, for instance, a flatbed truck with something covered or anything like
yes,
that?
Oh, yes. I've got those witnesses, too.
Oh, you do?
Yes, I do. Military trucks, unusual helicopter activity, people in officers' uniforms showing up at payphones in places where nobody ever normally sees the military. I mean, there's many aspects to this that I'm not telling you simply because we don't have, you know, huge amounts of time.
Now, this was in, you said, 1979?
That's correct. And the irony of this was it took place probably 30 miles from where I was a rookie policeman, because I started with the Aberdeen, Washington Police Department in May 20th of 1979, and I freely admit I was a young man. I was new to the police force, and of course you don't see much daylight when you're a rookie policeman, and I didn't read the newspaper. Had I read the newspaper, I would have seen that the headline for the Aberdeen newspaper on November 26th was UFO crash in Elk River, question mark. And that was followed by five other newspaper articles that even went as far as identifying witnesses and what they reported.
Were you able, in your search for witnesses, to find any of any military to come forward and say, "Yeah, I was there"?
No.
You know, reporting on UFOs has changed dramatically. In 1957, there was a UFO over Tucson, Arizona, and Davis Monthan Air Base sent a plane up. Actually, there was a plane already up, and they just redirected him to go check it out. The next day in the newspaper, on the front page of the newspaper, they had the pilot's picture and his testimony about what happened. They had the air traffic controller from Davis Monthan Air Base and what they saw on the radar and what he told the pilot to do. And, you know, all of that was just out in the open. And now a UFO could sit down at the Sonic restaurant and order hamburgers, and they would deny that it even existed. And the newspapers would say, "Well, some people believe they saw a UFO." You know, it really has changed, and it has changed rather drastically, and not for the better, in my opinion. And hopefully, this will turn around, and there'll be maybe some real reporting soon. I hope so. James, what are your plans for MUFON in Washington State?
Well, I'm still developing my base of field investigators. I'm always looking for more. I'm also trying to find meeting venues. It turns out that getting a meeting venue these days is not simple.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many volunteer organizations. If you get a private one, they want insurance. There's all sorts of complications. So this turns out not to be quite as easy as it once was. But I am working on it, and I continue my personal advocacy. I'm going to Roswell, and I'm going to be speaking there is my next engagement. And I just was at McMinnville, Oregon, and that was an absolutely fabulous conference.
All right. Well, you know, I wish you all the best. If somebody in Washington wants to be one of your field investigators, what do they need to do?
Well, they can either go through the MUFON.com website and start the process that way, or if they want to contact me by email, I have a website which is very simply ClarkSonUFO.com, ClarkSonUFO.com, and there is an email link, and I'd be happy to try and help them.
All right. And, folks, as always, if you go to my website, KevinSmithShow.com, many, many, many of you around the world are on my website right now. If you just click James Clarkson's photograph, it will take you to his website. It's linked to his website as well. James, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us this evening. It's been fascinating, and hopefully you'll come back and talk with us again in the future.
I would love to, Kevin. I've really enjoyed it, truly.
All right. If you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment as I close the show. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to be a wrap for this evening, and let me tell you, here at the Kevin Smith Show, you can always expect we're going to bring you interesting and I would say important information and great guests. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.